There's a lot of your work that says quite a lot of interesting things about the 20th century. Certainly the first thing that sprung to mind was From Hell. There's an idea in From Hell, which was a big inspiration of my KLF book. But the idea was that the act of Jack the Ripper was what gave birth to the 20th century. I was just curious where that idea came from.
Well, that was my conceit that resolved a lot of the material that had emerged during my research into From Hell.
Okay.
When I was just looking into the 1880s, I noticed all of these things that had happened. That I think in 1882, Michelson and Morley actually performed the experiments which were meant to iron out a couple of last wrinkles in the theory of the ether, but ended up completely disproving that ether existed, which was a kind of result, but not the one that they were looking for. You'd got France going into Indochina. You had got the beginnings of the modern art movement with Walter Sickert. You'd got some of the first kind of modern realist writings with people like Emile Zola. You'd got a surprising amount of focusing upon prostitutes in literature and the arts. And all of these things which had gone on to really colour and shape the 20th century. And then in 1888, these senseless, violent murders, it just seemed to me that symbolically I could kind of position the Jack the Ripper murders as the birth throes of the 20th century, with Jack the Ripper as a kind of really ghastly midwife.
yeah, and there's the whole tabloid sort of thing growing up around it, and that sort of violent sort of stew, so it sort of does all fit. What struck me about reading Providence, even though it's not so overtly about the 20th century, is the Lovecraftian worldview probably sums up that time better even than, you know, my book or anything deliberately about the 20th century. Is it, do you see it as a...
Well, yeah, I mean, I see researching Providence was quite an eye-opener. And it changed my opinion of Lovecraft, not of his stature as a writer. In fact, I think that only continues to increase the more I think about him. But more of an understanding of him in relation to his times. The thing is, Lovecraft is generally positioned as an outsider, probably because that was the name of one of his most famous stories, so it's not much of a reach. But you actually look at Lovecraft, he was homophobic. This at a time when gay men, principally gay men, some gay women as well, but that was different, were starting to emerge quite vocally and very visibly onto the streets of New York. There was a huge gay subculture in the early 20th century New York. It wasn't just something that started after the Second World War. And these were becoming more visible. You'd got women. I mean, Lovecraft was certainly not a misogynist, but he was perhaps somewhat awkward or conflicted in his relationships with women. This was at a time when women were just about to get the vote. There had been 20 years of the biggest influx of immigrants that America had ever seen up until 1910, 1920. And that had led to conservative fears that American identity was going to be lost beneath a tidal wave of miscegenation, inbreeding, sort of, that all of these fears were exactly those of the white middle class, common man. I mean, the Russian Revolution had just happened in 1917. Mm-hmm. And in America, there were all of these strikes, which at the time looked like, oh, it's going to happen over here. In fact, most people, when you talk about the Red Scare, they think, oh, that's the 1950s, that's McCarthyism. The Red Scare was 1919. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, Lovecraft became a perfect barometer because he was so sensitive, so unbearably sensitive. Then all of the fears of the early 20th century, including the fears of man's relegation in importance, given what we were starting to understand about the cosmos. Yeah. Lovecraft was, unlike other people of his day, he actually understood that stuff. He was very quick. He didn't like Einstein, but he was very quick to assimilate Einstein's ideas. He didn't like quantum theory, but he almost understood it. Yeah, this was it. He, in some ways, his stories represented the kind of landscape of fear, the territory of fear, for the 20th century as a whole.
Because he didn't like the modernists at all, in terms of writing and things like that.
But he was conflicted. He was a closet modernist himself. I mean, yeah, he hated Gertrude Stein, T.S. Eliot, James Joyce. He wrote a brilliantly funny and actually very well written parody of The Wasteland called Waste Paper. But you actually look at Lovecraft's writing, and much as he's decrying all of the modernists and much as he's bigging up his favourite 18th century authors, people like Pope, actually, Lovecraft is a modernist. He's using stream of consciousness techniques. He is using glossolalia more impenetrable than anything in Finnegan's Wake. He is using techniques of deliberately alienating the reader or confusing the reader. His descriptions tend to be along the lines of, here's three things that Cthulhu doesn't look like. Or he'll describe the colour out of space as only a colour by analogy. So what, is it a sound? Is it a rough texture or a smell? What? These are deliberate kind of techniques. They're not flaws. They are techniques at alienating the reader, of putting the reader into an uncanny space where language is no longer capable of describing the experience.
Yeah, and it that was sort of, for horror, it was all the gothic horror had sort of gone, and it was just this sort of modern horror.
That's important, because all horror, or most horror, up to Lovecraft, had all been predicated upon the gothic tradition, which is a tradition where you have an enormous vertical weight in time that is bearing down upon a fragile present. A history of dark things in the past that are leading up to some terrifying denouement in the present day. With Lovecraft, yes, there is an awful lot of talking about remote antiquity and the past. But with Lovecraft, I think that it's a much more present horror of the future. Mm. He's talking about that time when man will be able to organise all of his knowledge. And when that time comes, the only question is whether we will embrace this new illuminating light or whether we will flee from it into the reassuring shadows of a new dark age.
Yeah.
Which is very prescient. Given, say, current fundamentalism, which is a response to too much knowledge, too much information. Let's take it all back to something that we're sure of, that God created the world in 6 days. Mm. In that way, Lovecraft was sort of, he was really exploring all of that. He was a very he is still a very contemporary writer.
Mm.
I think that if you wanted to do as Michael Moorcock did in the 60s, Michael Moorcock was mainly interested in modernism. He noticed that the science fiction genre was laying around with its wheels off and that nobody was doing much with it apart from kind of cowboys in space. So he thought, why don't we hijack this and make science fiction a vehicle for modernism?
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, J.G. Ballard, all the rest. I think you could do the same thing with Lovecraft, alone amongst horror writers.
Yeah.
I think that Lovecraft's preoccupations were so forward-looking that, and his writing techniques were so unusual that, yeah, you could use Lovecraft as the starting point for a new kind of modernist horror, if you will.
Because that sense of linking the 20th century to this sort of impending horror reminds me a bit of Century, your League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, volume 3, the Century one, but which for my mind is probably the bleakest of all the League sort of thing, if you think that's fair. It's got that sense that the creative imagination withers away during the 20th century. Is that what you're aiming for?
Yes, it was. I got quite a bit of criticism for that. I know that people were saying after reading the third book, they said that it was my equivalent of saying it were all fields round here once, which it wasn't. Yeah. That wasn't what I was saying.
Yeah.
But what I was saying was that I don't think it was unfair to choose the Beggar's Opera as representing a big, important cultural event of 1910.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was unfair choosing Donald Camel's performance as representing a big, important cultural event in 1969. And I don't think it was unfair choosing J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter as representing a big cultural event from the early 21st century. I would say that if you were to plot those things upon a graph, the line isn't going up.
Yes.
I think that it's a fair comment
that
our approach to culture has, in the mainstream, has degenerated. The values that people used to put into a work of art, those have been eroded. And yeah, I was trying to express that in the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, because the whole of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, it's about this massive planet of fiction that has been a kind of a counterpart to our own world for as long as we've had fiction. That we've made up this world, that it's the world we want, the exciting world where exciting things happen and meaningful things happen.
Yeah.
And if you look at those two worlds, there's interesting points of comparison, that they had similar events that shaped them, but slightly different, and they worked out slightly differently. And so, yeah, in Century, it was using the League to look at the 20th century from the point of view of 20th century culture and to draw what conclusions seemed accurate. I wasn't saying that all culture in the late 20th century was rubbish. I wasn't saying that culture was doomed. I was saying that mainstream culture was becoming repetitive, was not having original ideas, would no longer be capable of coming up with a performance, let alone a Throckney opera.
Yeah, it's. I mean, what struck me when I was doing my 20th century book was especially all the guys who took us into space, took us into the moon, Sir Guy Korolev, Wernher von Braun, the importance of Jules Verne to them, in that culture of Buck Rogers and Flash yeah. Gordon and things like that. And I was thinking about that when I was watching. Do you know, have you seen Prometheus? It's really grim. It's basically they realise humanity's been built by aliens, so they go off to find these aliens, and they finally find an alien to say, oh godlike thing, why did you create us? And the alien goes, oh, what are these things do being still around? And just starts like punching them in the face to sort of kill them. And it's about as bleak an idea as you can imagine. And I just kind of wonder if Wernher von Braun and those guys were growing up with that level of science fiction, whether they've been quite so keen to sort of go to the moon and sort of push it forward.
Well, I mean, I think that, science fiction, it's interesting what the way that science fiction was handled in the 20th century.
Hmm.
Science fiction, all right, there's a lot of precursors for it, but a non-controversial starting point would probably be Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And then you'd move on to people like Wells and Verne about a century later. Now, all of those are actually kind of grim warning visions of the potential future. They are potentially alarmist mm-hmm. about the nature of technology and what it will mean. With Mary Shelley, she was reacting to the Industrial Revolution, which was actually starting up around her while she was writing Frankenstein in 1814 or whenever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Wells, he is, all of his science fiction books are for the most part dystopias. The Time Machine, with its view of the class system of Wells's day, even more stratified, literally, so that you've got working class cannibals living underground and feeding upon these dopey, drippy, middle class sort of food animals, basically.
It's the austerity story, sort
yeah.
of.
Yes, exactly. It's and Jules Verne. Now, obviously, Jules Verne is getting much more of a kick mm-hmm. out of his big machines, but he always says, and imagine if these machines were to fall into the hands of a madman like Captain Nemo, who I secretly admire. But at least it is a warning.
Mm.
1910, 1915. America discovers science fiction in the form of Tom Swift. Mm. And it is a different thing altogether. It is not about giving dire warnings for the future. It is about saying, look how great America's going to be in the future.
Mm.
It's almost, I suspect, like the tendency in older nations when we want to big ourselves up is to reach back to the past, to something imaginary in the past, like King Arthur or something mm-hmm. like that. America hasn't got that amount of history to deal with. So in some ways, what America needs is science fiction. When we're trying to say, look at what we were, then America more or less has to say, look at what we will be. And so their science fiction from the 1920s with the boom of the pulp magazines, it was all of this bright, optimistic, new frontier stuff where it was going to be cowboys and Indians all over again, only it was going to be Earthmen and Neptunians. Mm. But you could just go through the whole of the tropes of the Western genre and pioneer fiction, but in space. And it became this, in my opinion, that was probably one of the worst things to ever happen to science fiction. It took until the late 1940s, after Hiroshima, for these new voices that had got a radical sense of doubt to start to creep back into science fiction. And that gave a brilliant era, probably the best era of science fiction, from say, late 40s to the mid 70s, when George Lucas brought out Star Wars, a piece of fundamentalist science fiction, if ever there was one, and turned the clocks back to the science fiction ideas of 50 years before.
Because now we're in the position, that whole idea between science fiction and the real world interacting with each other. Now we get things like Black Mirror with the pig, and then on Monday, that's no longer science fiction. It's the, whether this is the sort of level of leeway between fiction and non-fiction that we wanted at the end of this period.
Well, I mean, I have said in the past that I believe that the membrane between fiction and fact is porous and semi-permeable, and I have become used to my most ridiculous ideas, whether that be coming up with V for Vendetta and then suddenly seeing a load of Guy Fawkes masked anarchists invading the world stage, which is a good thing, or the having come up with the idea related to my film project, Jimmy's End, of having a sinister clown manifesting in various locations around Northampton and returning from holiday and finding that a sinister clown had manifested in Northampton at the end of my street, about 100 yards from my front door. You start to get the impression that, yes, sometimes things can kind of percolate through from the realm of ideas into the realm of actuality. I would say to Charlie Brooker that it's his own fault, that sort of he shouldn't have written about British prime ministers in an unholy relationship with a pig if he didn't want this to happen. You know, so happy now.
This is assuming, of course, that it's not true, which I like to think it probably isn't true, and that Lord Ashcroft is enough of a shit to have done that. But part of me, it just sort of, it fits a bit too well. It just feels a bit too much like a real occult initiation sort of ceremony.
I remember somebody saying this might have been someone like Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo, saying about the idea of Donnie and Marie Osmond being married. And he was saying, yeah, I know that that's not really true, but in my heart it's true. And I think that that is the way that I feel about the revelations about David Cameron, that sort of we all know that in his secret soul, David Cameron is exactly the man who would do something like that. If he has not done it literally, he has certainly done it metaphorically. I say that sort of without a shred of evidence that I am going to believe that for the rest of my life.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Alan.
We will go
forward to the 21st century with that as the start of our doctorate of imagination. Thank you.